The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Slime, spacecraft, and children's TV programs. No, we're not talking about what you got up to during the summer holidays, but the latest trends in EIS investments. Organisations providing free debt advice have told the FT they face a funding crisis as more people are getting into problem debt, but fewer debt collection companies are paying the voluntary levy they rely on to provide a free service. We assess the issues and also take a look at problems at payday lender Wonga. And finally, child trust funds come of age. Millions of children have a CTF account lurking around somewhere, but did you know they can make their own investment decisions when they turn 16? Welcome to The Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm Claire Barrett, FT Money Editor, bringing you all of this week's money news. Enterprise investment schemes, more commonly known as EIS, have surged in popularity with wealthy investors, offering tax breaks on a variety of investments in increasingly wacky or adventurous areas. Joining me to discuss how slime, spacecraft and even children's TV could yet find a place in your portfolio is Kate Bearley, reporter with FT Money. Welcome, Kate.
Hello.
So before we talk in more detail about the trends, give us the lowdown about how EIS actually works.
Yeah, so EIS was a scheme introduced by the government in the 90s as a way to fund very small, innovative young companies. And in return for investors taking those risks on companies which could fail or take a long time to come to fruition, investors receive very generous tax relief. And so that relief includes 30% income tax relief on your investment as long as you hold the EIS shares for 3 years. You also get tax-free growth, so no capital gains tax to pay on those shares, again, if you hold them for 3 years. And you can defer tax on capital gains elsewhere, like property, for example, by investing those into EIS with some restrictions. Finally, you can also offset losses against income tax, meaning your original exposure is reduced. So EIS has become more popular with investors in recent years as the tax relief on pensions has been cut back. So a great number of wealthy people have really seen the amount that they can save into a pension annually and over their lifetime cut back quite severely. But obviously, EIS, it's very high risk, which explains the generous relief on offer. EIS shares are not liquid. You can't easily sell them on. It's very unlikely you're going to see any returns at all for several years at least. And then you can't sell them for at least 3 years without losing all of that tax relief. So very long-term investments for people who don't need the money for quite a long time and have potentially quite a lot of money to put into these things too.
Indeed. So there are a lot of restrictions also on the type of enterprises that qualify, and that's changed over the years. And it partly explains the far-out nature of some of the investments that you've looked at in your article.
Well, yeah, companies qualifying for EIS, they're small, they're usually privately owned, although they can be listed on the AIM market. They'll typically have assets of less than 15 million and not as many employees as larger companies, although there are some now more relaxed rules for so-called knowledge-intensive firms, which are kind of basically companies with higher kind of costs and more skilled staff. Biotech might be a good example. But yes, so that explains why things I've looked at in this article include an algae farm, a children's TV company, and space technology used on things like satellite dishes. So it's quite all kind of weird and wonderful stuff.
Well, absolutely fascinating to read about. But what about kicking the tyres of these investments? I mean, will we all be eating slime in the future from this algae farm we visited?
Yeah, well, there, it turns out, are some major plus points to algae, which I do talk about in this feature. It's actually in an amazing number of things, from things like meat-free burgers that you might buy in shops to those diet supplements you buy in
spirulina
place
pills.
Like, exactly, yeah. Holland and Barrett, to expensive face creams. Turns out that L'Oreal is the number one patent holder of algae in the world. So in fact, algae, from the kind of eating perspective, the human eating perspective, contains three times as much protein as beef, and you can actually produce it in fairly large quantities in an algae farm. But there are a lot of risks in producing algae, particularly for things like algae burgers, which obviously don't sound automatically appealing. You know, this, the main current use of it is fish feed, where there is already an established market. But as we've just said, the term algae burger, it doesn't kind of sound appetizing to us now. Things like the alternative protein market, that's a still fairly small market, and it's quite trend-led, you know, this desire for people to eat less meat, kind of flexitarianism.
Flexitarian, that's a new one on me. Yeah. Word of the week, I feel.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a kind of small market, and this algae farm has yet to produce algae on the commercial scale that you would need to make it work. So there's the issue there of, like, proving that commercial scale and also proving the demand that would kind of push forward that trend.
So, and in the feature, you give us the full rundown on this particular EIS investment, how investors should kick the tyres, and as a general rule of thumb, fund managers will give returns, but they should be taken with a pinch of salt. Should also look out for their fees, which can be quite hefty because this is a very specialist type of investment, how they'll impact on your returns, and also the minimum investment size, because that can often be quite chunky. So finally, investing in space technology. I mean, of all of the things that you wrote about in your feature, I think that is what has kind of provoked the most comment from people who read the article. I mean, it sounds very futuristic, but it's quite a crowded area.
Yeah, I mean, space is clearly a pretty sexy investment concept at the moment, but any EIS investors are going up against some of the world's most powerful, richest investors, including, you know, Amazon's Jeff Bezos and Tesla's Elon Musk. Musk has rocket company SpaceX, which famously launched Tesla into space in February while playing David Bowie's Space Oddity. And then you've got Jeff Bezos, who told a conference recently that he was selling $1 billion in Amazon stock every year to invest in his aerospace company Blue Origin. So there is a sense here that you are putting some of your own money into a small EIS fund or company, you know, there's a risk that you will never match the might of Bezos or Musk.
Yeah, and certainly a very, very crowded area, but one that's absolutely fascinating to read about. Thank you very much there to Kate Beely, reporter with FT Money. You can read her full article, How to Invest in the Next Big Thing, online now at ft.com/money. The plight of severely indebted consumers has been at the top of the news agenda this week. The payday lender Wonga is, at the time of recording this podcast, assessing all options, including potentially calling in administrators. It blames the costs arising from a spike in the number of compensation claims from customers who claim they were granted loans they could not afford. Well, the Wonga news comes just days after the FT reported that two of the UK's biggest providers of free debt advice were warning their funding model was under strain due to more consumers falling into problem debt. Joining me now in the studio to discuss is John Fairhurst, the Executive Director of PayPlan. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
So the debt advice sector has got two problems. The first big one being the rising number of people who need your help.
Yes, problem debt does tend to be quite cyclical. Post the banking crisis, we saw quite a sharp reduction in consumer borrowing. Banks weren't too keen on lending. Borrowers weren't too keen on borrowing. But since the low point in 2013, we've seen about a one-third rise in the amounts of credit outstanding. And current estimates put the number of people who are struggling with those debts at 8 million. Although
that's a shocking number.
It is.
8 million people.
Although that said, only 1.1 million sought advice last year. So the proportion of people in debt who seek advice is relatively modest at the moment.
And you think that those numbers are going to increase. The government also thinks that they're going to increase, but you disagree on the rate.
Yes, the shape of the market is changing. The people our clients owe money to are increasingly not the people they borrowed that money from. Less than half of the money that our clients owe is owed to the creditors who actually lent them the money. There's been quite a growth in the debt sale market. And as that market grows, the participation in the funding model which we run, which is a voluntary funding model, has been declining.
So those kind of companies who are buying bad debts are private firms of, you know, debt collectors who are paying quite a small price. You've said maybe as little as 5 pennies in the pound to acquire that distressed debt, and then they will chase after the payment maybe more aggressively than the originator of the debt. Maybe that was a high street bank or a credit card company, but the new people who've bought it will pursue it with more vigour.
Yeah, these people are of course bound by the FCA regulations which cover debt collection. But their objective is to collect in debt. They still receive the benefit of our advice. We still help our clients repay money to them in the same way as we would to someone who supports us. They're just increasingly choosing not to pay us for that advice, which of course limits our ability to grow our capacity and to engage with as many consumers as we feel we need to.
With that in mind, you fear there are a number of events in the coming months that could really push up demand for your services. So talk us through some of those.
Yeah. A lot of the growth in debt advice historically has been a behavioural one. When consumers become more worried about their debts, they're more likely to seek help for those debt problems. Remember, out of 8 million, currently only 1.1 million are seeking help. We've got a few events on the horizon. So next month in September, new rules that the FCA have issued for credit card firms will require those firms to pay special attention to people who persistently make minimum repayments on credit cards. And so those people are generally going to be asked to pay more towards their credit card debts each month. And for people on a tight budget that's fully committed, that we believe will cause some problems. Next year, the government's introducing a breathing space scheme to make access to debt advice easier and to give consumers more certainty about the behaviour of creditors. But that, again, we believe will produce a spike in demand. And of course, on top of that, any economic downturn, Brexit springs to mind,
yes,
may well provoke another jump in demand.
And all the time, the funding is a big problem for you, as we wrote in the piece. So we'll keep following that story as developments happen. The trade body that represents some of the debt collectors we mentioned is committed, it says, to making them all contribute to your Fair Deal funding model. So how confident are you that they'll fall into line?
We are hopeful. We've got a good level of engagement with the credit industry at the moment. The Money Advice Service is coordinating some efforts to fix these funding problems. And we're hopeful that Treasury will get involved as well. So our hope is that by Christmas we will have made some meaningful progress on this.
And finally, I'm keen to ask you for your views on Wonga and what its potential exit from the short-term high-cost credit market could mean for the millions of consumers who've come to rely on payday lenders.
Well, of course, people who owe money to Wonga will still owe money, whatever happens to Wonga. Mm. I think looking forward, we generally discourage people from using payday lenders if they can avoid it. It's a very expensive way to borrow money. Traditionally, a payday loan is a few hundred pounds for a few weeks. The approach we encourage people to take is to try and build in a bit of headroom into their domestic budgets. It can be very difficult managing on a tight budget, particularly when you have debts as well. But creating a bit of headroom to improve that resilience can really reduce the need to use those lenders. If people are struggling to do that, the best advice, I think, is to get debt advice. A debt advisor will help people work out an affordable budget and, where necessary, help to renegotiate payments with their existing lenders and potentially identify ways to improve their income and reduce their outgoings. Things like utility switching, checking tax codes, those sorts of things are often quite helpful in giving people the ability to manage more reliably on a week-by-week basis during the month.
Well, thanks very much there to John Fairhurst, Executive Director of PayPlan, the UK provider of free debt advice. You can read more on this story in FT Money in the FT Weekend newspaper this week from Saturday, or check out our website now, ft.com/money. Finally, from the age of 16, young people can legally buy a lottery ticket, get married, or, gasp, have sex. But now that the first child trust funds are coming of age, a growing crop of 16-year-olds in Britain could also take control of their investment choices for the first time. Something that may come as a surprise, and perhaps a worry, to parents who set up the accounts. Joining me now with the story is Lucy Warwick-Ching, FT Money's digital editor. Welcome, Lucy.
Hello.
So, great response to your column. I mean, there are millions of these child trust fund accounts sitting around. So, I mean, to start with, how will you know if you or your child has one?
So if you're a parent of a child that was born between September 2002 and January 2011, then they will have had one set up, or you will have set up one for them. So there's kind of, I think there's 6 million accounts that have been set up within this time. And the government gave all parents with children that were of this age at least £250, and then lower income families were given £500 in the kind of form of a voucher, so you could choose whether to set up a few different accounts, but the default option was a stakeholder account, so it was invested in say a low-cost tracker, or you could invest it in specific stocks or bonds.
Yeah. So many people won't have really paid much attention to this child trust fund account, of course, superseded since then by the junior ISA. So it is a bit of a legacy concern. But under the rules, the child in question won't be allowed to take any money out until they reach the age of 18. But from the age of 16, they can make the investment decisions. Now, this is something that you argue parents should view as an opportunity, not a threat.
So the original aim of the child trust funds was to give every child a financial head start. So the thinking was that getting children interested in investing and understanding their money would actually help young people. And this is still the aim that should be in the forefront of parents' minds when they're thinking about these child trust funds. Everyone's always talking about, and we've talked about it on the show, the importance of getting young people to think about money and understand money and take charge of their own personal finances. We've heard about debt problems on this show alone. And so it's really important for young people to be, you know, as early as possible, be thinking about their money. And that's what they can do from 16. They can't take out the money, which some parents will be happy about. So they can only take the money out at age 18. But if from 16, they're thinking about where this money is going, how it's being invested, they're seeing the returns that they're getting are going up, hopefully, then actually when they hit 18, then they might be tempted to carry on investing that money and not fritter that money
not
away.
Not blow it all on fast cars a holiday or something like that. But then it's also the conversations that it could spark, you know, other lessons that could be learned. For example, my stepson, he doesn't have one of these accounts, he's too old, but he has said to me before, you know, should I invest in Bitcoin? And you can imagine what my answer to that has been. But there are other lessons that could come out of these conversations too.
Exactly. There are very important lessons such as high charges. So the child trust funds have come under a lot of stick in the last few years because as many parents have not really taken an interest in them, the amounts of money in these child trust funds were very low. So, you know, they are quite high charges on some of these funds. And as the money inside these child trust funds, it's not a huge amount of money, then it's actually very noticeable that these high charges are eating away at these investment returns. So that teaches children that, you know, you should be focusing on how much these organisations are taking in fees, and maybe children will be interested in switching around and getting the cheapest fees on their funds.
Absolutely. A great project for the end of the school holidays. But finally, what's your advice for those listening who think, damn it, I know I had one of those accounts, but I don't know what's happened to it?
One in six of these accounts are lost. And so they're marked by HMRC as addressee gone away because perhaps they were set up and invested by the government into one of these default accounts, and the HMRC can't trace the owners of these
families
accounts.
Moved away, exactly. Moved several times.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Although I'm a bit dubious about this argument because perhaps some of these families have been, you know, they might be receiving benefits, or, you know, I feel like more should be done and more is being done to trace these families because these often are disadvantaged children. So that money could give them a much better start in life. But also if you've lost the paperwork, then actually it is easier than you think to track
down one of these accounts.
What do we do?
No. So first of all, you need to set up a government gateway account if you don't have one already.
Anyone who does a tax return will have one, I can attest.
Yeah. And then you just put in your details about yourself and your child, and the government says it will find it for you. So if you've got all the details to hand, it's probably about an hour's worth of your time, but actually it could really be worthwhile doing it.
Well, thanks very much there to Lucy Warwick-Ching. You can read her Family Money column, all about child trust funds, online now, ft.com/money. If you want to contact the FT Money team, you can email us money@ft.com or follow us on Twitter @ftmoney. And finally, a bit of breaking news. If you like hearing me waffle on about business and finance, then you're in luck. From September, I'm going to be doing it every day with the broadcaster Eddie Mayer on his new Drive Time show on LBC. Tune in weekdays around 5:30 p.m. to hear us talk about the big story of the day. And before you ask, of course, I will still be recording the FT podcast and editing the money section every week. We'll be back next Thursday at the usual time. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.